lady for quite some time. Joanne from La Mesa.
Hi, everybody. I thought we were going to read something first, but I'm Joanne. I'm alcoholic. So I wasn't expecting to be up here so quick. I'm supposed to get up here and tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, and I'm going to try to do that. The last time I spoke in December in Santee, there's some people in this room that said, I hope she sobers up this time. So I was going to take my watch off and put it up here and do like 15, 15, 15, like Lori, my friend Lori that spoke 2 weeks ago. I don't think I'll stand up to Lori 2 weeks ago. She was pretty funny. I want to welcome all the newcomers here, and I want to thank everybody for having me here to share. I'm not a circus speaker. I have spoken a few times, I'm going to tell you my story, and I only got one, so I'm going to go with it. I wanted to congratulate, is it Paul and Scott? And what I noticed about Paul and Scott is they're both participants in this meeting, and I'm a participant. When I got sober, they asked me to participate in AA, and I walked in the Old Town Speakers meeting on September 28, 1986, and the following week, they had me greeting at the door. You know, I'm kind of overwhelmed with emotion because I never had to drink again after that day when I walked into that meeting. I used to say it was my first meeting, but I went to a meeting with a guy that I tried to get sober once before, and I thought, those people weren't too bad. You know, they're just like me. But it took me a few more years to get sober and realize that I had a problem. I learned to participate very early at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a participant today. A year or more ago, I was the after-hours chairman at the Coordinating Council. I've been secretaries. I've been GSR's Coordinating Council. I've done all kinds of participation. And if you want to stay sober, you find somebody that participates in Alcoholics Anonymous and grab onto them, because I think that's going to help you stay sober. It could be the coffee maker. It could be the speaker person. It could be the literature person. It doesn't matter. You know, just grab onto somebody that's participating in. And I found sobriety through participating in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, in saying that, I brought some little things. I'm still a rebel. I brought the non-AA approved literature. This was the only 24-hour day book that we had when I got sober. And my husband is the one that utilizes it, but I brought it for a little later. But anyway, I was born at Grossman Hospital in the first 6 months it was open in 1956, and I was the third child of a doctor in Lemon Grove, and they had seven girls in our family, so I was the third of seven. So we were all girls, and my dad was the only boy in his family, and he wanted a boy. And so we all kind of got a message, I used to kid, that we weren't the boy that my dad wanted. And he really wanted a boy. And so we sort of got this feeling that we weren't quite good enough because we weren't the boy that my dad wanted. Even though they loved us and cared for us and took care of us to the best they could, you know, I sort of got that message early on that I wasn't quite enough because I wasn't the boy. And that he wanted a boy that could become a doctor just like him, like his father, you know, in that generation. That women really, he wasn't considering that the woman could do that. And today he has a doctor. It's not me. It's my sister Patty, number five. And she became his dream, you know. So I'm happy for him for that. But there were seven girls. I'm the only recovering alcoholic in my family. There's not any other, you know, drunks falling out of the family. My mother's mother was an alcoholic, so my maternal grandmother was an alcoholic. They used to say that she was crazy, so they put her in a crazy home. They never really said the word alcoholic, but she died. She had my uncle, who's about 67 years old now, and he's a fetal alcohol syndrome, and so she had him, and about 2 years later she died. So she had a son that was affected by alcoholism and was mentally handicapped from that. And she died when my mom was 12. So I don't really know that grandma that was the alcoholic. I thought on my dad's side of the family, he sort of got that rageaholism. He doesn't really have the alcoholism, you know, but he's kind of like an anger problem. So there is the ism active and alive in my family. My older sister is married to an alcoholic who's been to AA meetings. My next sister is probably an alcoholic. I'm the third one. The fourth one is married to a guy that his first wife was alcoholic, and they both got the isms and hook up real well. My fifth sister is the doctor, and her husband has been, you know, has busted out all the windows in their house, but he, you know, he just got a little upset. He might be alcoholic. My sixth sister, her husband's family is riddled with alcoholism. And my sister had a family intervention for my sister that's not sober, the one above me, talks about food. So she kind of has food issues. And then Tammy is the youngest. We still haven't figured her out yet, and she's almost 42. But I don't know, what about a knife? Oh, yeah, I guess she did swing a knife at somebody at Thanksgiving one time. She might have some anger issues. Somebody wasn't doing it her way. But anyway, so I don't come from a family of alcoholism. It's not drinking, partying, everybody's drunk, passed out on the floor, but, you know, it's not real good function. And so when I grew up, I had that feeling that I wasn't quite good enough. I didn't feel like I fit in. I just told my daughter this the other day. My teeth grew in kind of really crooked, the front four, and were really kind of ugly. Plus the fact my dad gave me tetracycline as a kid, so they were brown. And so I had to have braces like when I was in fourth grade for those front four teeth, and then I had to have them again. So, you know, I didn't have the biggest self-esteem. And I heard my babysitter talking to some lady one time that said that I was exceptional, but I didn't know what exceptional was. I was pretty young. I guess I was stupid, didn't know what exceptional was. But I thought there was something wrong with me and I was going to die and they weren't telling me. You know, so I just sort of had this unsettling fear that things weren't quite right, you know, and that there was something wrong with me and they weren't telling me and all that kind of stuff. So I grew up, and by the time I got into high school, in junior high I had my first drink, and it was at a boy-girl party when I was in seventh or eighth grade, and they told me that I drank like a fish. I guess I liked the beer, and I became boisterous and talkative, and you know, I liked the way it made me feel, and I wanted to do it again, you know, and I didn't do it again right away because the opportunities were not really there for me, but in junior high, my sister must have been driving by then, and we went to the Ace Drive-In in Lemon Grove, and everybody remember the Ace Drive-In? And my sister and this guy that my sister, other sister liked, were smoking pot in the car. And so I was around people smoking marijuana and that kind of stuff. But I thought, I won't ever do that. You know, I won't, you know, that's against the law. I won't do that. I'm a good girl. And, you know, within a couple years, I was drinking, drugging, and doing all that. So by the time I was in high school, I was 15 or 16. I had an older sister that drove. She took us, we started lying to my parents pretty regularly on Friday nights when the football games were going on. We were going to keg parties. So we, you know, started the regular hanging out at keg parties. In fact, there was a saying at our keg parties at Helix that there was only one Brumbaugh girl there, then there's two Brumbaugh girls there. Oh, there's three, there's a party, you know. You know, if all three Brumbaugh girls were there for the party. And and so we were known as the party girls, and everybody was, the phone started ringing off the hook on Friday night to find out where the party was and where we were going to go drink that night, and it just became a regular occurrence on Friday night to drink. Around that same time, I think that even though I'd been brought up in the church and brought up religious. There were some, you know, issues in religion in my background. My mother was Catholic. My father was Protestant, and they tried to break up because they weren't of the same religion. My dad moved out here to start his medical practice, and he couldn't live without her, so he went back and got her. Her mom disowned her. Her grandmother disowned her because her mom was already dead because she didn't get married in a Catholic church. So we were brought up Protestant with this ex-Catholic mother, and I still got all the Catholic guilt, you know. So I was brought up in the church where God is love, and they played guitars, and I thought it was wonderful, and I sang in the choir. But as soon as I started drinking, you know, I lied to my parents, told them I was going somewhere different. I didn't tell them what I was up to, and didn't feel too guilty about it, because if I was drunk and having fun, I didn't really feel too guilty about lying to them. But under now, deep down, I did, you know, I guess it changed, you know, my belief system was changing. As I drank, you know, things were getting a little different. So I went off to college. I decided to become a nurse, and my mother was a nurse. And my parents still wanted me to kind of, I said, "You sure you don't want to be a doctor?" And I said, "No, I don't want to be a doctor. I want to be a nurse." And the Grossman College was pretty filled up with like 300 applicants for 30 spots at the time. So I found a school in Arizona, and Arizona's drinking age was 19, and I was 19, and I thought, that's a great fit, you know. So I went off to Northern Arizona University to go to school and get my nursing degree. I went over there. I stayed here a year, went to Grossman College for a year, and when I went over there, so I was 19, I went with an orientation group that were all 18-year-olds first out of high school, and I had already had a year and was older than them. So I ran around at this three-day orientation looking for somebody to go drink with, and somebody that was old enough to go to the bar, because I wanted to go to the bar. I was in Arizona. It was legal for me to walk into a bar and order a drink. And it was going to be fun, you know. So I couldn't find anybody, so I wasn't going to let the opportunity pass by. So I went by myself. And I was lucky. I didn't know where in Arizona or where in Flagstaff, Arizona, were the good bars or where to go. And I ended up at a bar and said, "I want to have one of those tall neck Budweiser," you know. I was so excited to get one. And I wanted to play pool and have the whole experience. And these guys said, "Didn't you know?" This guy came up behind me and said, "Didn't you know it's against the law for a girl in Arizona to come to a bar by herself?" And I thought, uh-oh, I don't know all the rules over here. And he was just kidding with me, but the bartender said, "You leave her alone." And I was protected. Lady bartender protected me. And it was I'm very lucky that I didn't go home with a truck driver that night or end up, you know, in a seedy hotel in Flagstaff, Arizona, and got out of control. I managed to make it back to the dorm and without any consequences. But that was the beginning of my drinking career in bars when I went away to school. So I was well on my way to alcoholism. I was drinking regularly. I continued to do that in college. I did manage to do very well in school, even though I drank, and passed my nursing degree. So when I was 21, I graduated from the nursing school and came back to San Diego. And I had gotten a boyfriend when I went away to school. I can't remember where I got Clyde. I came home, I think I came home right before I was getting ready to go, and we hooked up and got drunk and high together and fell in love, and then I went away to school, and so I'm away at school going, "I have this boyfriend at home," you know, so I didn't, you know, sleep around with a bunch of guys at school. I guess that was the consequences of that, but anyway. When I did come home for one of my first breaks, he had slept with my best friend, and I was a little angry about that, but I wasn't giving him up, and because we were in love, and you know, once I hook up with you, I have this bonding experience. So anyway, So I came home from school. I was 21. I passed my nursing degree, and I got an apartment with Clyde. And Clyde and I went on to live happily ever after. We continued to party and drink on a regular basis. I started working as an RN, and already in a few months, I had the feeling I was like that old country song, "Is that all there is?" You know, because I just sort of felt like, you know, this is it. You know, I should be on the top of my game. I just knew how to start a career, all this, and it just didn't feel right. It was like, okay, am I good enough yet? And I still didn't feel good enough inside. And so, and I was partying regularly. And, you know, he had messed around on me, and probably had a resentment around that. And, you know, we went on like that for a year, year and a half, and sometime shortly after that, we broke up. It got physical in the relationship. I lived in a two-story apartment, and we fought a lot. We yelled and screamed, and then I made him move out. I don't know whether he wasn't working or I just could afford it on my own, but I got him to leave, and I felt like I was going through my first divorce, although I'd never been married, you know. And I told my mom that. I remember telling her I was very sad, very upset. And I started hanging out at the pool. And I tell people I live upstairs in 41. They go, oh. They go, oh, where all that yelling was coming from, you know. And I was like, oh, yeah, he's gone. Like, no big deal, you know. So I just continued on like that. Now, I went through a series of men. I was a serial monogamous, you know, and never got married. And about 3 years before I got sober, I got a 502. That's what they were called then, right? Drunk driving. And I got scared. I was really more high on cocaine and all that, but they managed to find enough alcohol in my system to charge me with drunk driving. And because I'd gone on to other things by then. And so I got arrested and got taken to Las Colinas in Santee. And I called my boyfriend at the time, and he was coming to get me. He got down there. He was so drunk that they wouldn't release me to him. So he couldn't pick me up. I mean, I'm surprised I didn't follow him home, but somehow I think I ended up having to call my sister because I wasn't going to call my parents because I was too ashamed to call my parents. And so my sister came, and we lived in a little apartment at the end down by Mass where they built that big bridge at Mission Gorge and Mass in my mom and dad's condo. So I got really scared because this is when they changed the law and said that people had to start serving time in jail when they got 502s. They had to do weekends or wash cars or do something. And so about a month later, I ran away from home and moved to Mammoth. And so I decided I would hire an attorney and move to Mammoth, and then maybe it would all go away. So I hired an attorney, moved to Mammoth, but I forgot to tell my mom and dad that I was moving away. And left the drug addict and drug dealer in the condo that they owned, and moved to Mammoth. And it got to be my birthday. My birthday's in January, and I decided I need a little familiar company, so I called my mom and dad drunk and said, "Guess what? I moved to Mammoth." And they go, "Oh, well, we wondered what happened to you. You know, I've been gone for like 3 weeks. They didn't know where I was." And I said, "It's all going to be all better here." And I even called. I was working at Kaiser at the time, and I even called. I was a nurse. And I had called in sick so many times to Kaiser that they put up a sign in the nurse's lounge that said, "Joanne called in dead today because she used up all her sick leave." And so I'm in Mammoth. I got a job at the Mammoth Hospital, Mammoth Lakes Hospital. I left the drug dealer at home. This other guy had come to save me. And so I was living with this other guy, my old boyfriend, Steve, in Mammoth. And we were going to live happily ever after because we were bonded. And I got up there and found a place to live with him, and it was in a little log cabin in what they call the ghetto. It's the lowest section in Mammoth, and it was 19, 83, and there was a lot of snow in 1983 in Mammoth. And so when you walked into my log cabin, there was a walkway with walls of snow about this high that you kind of slid down into the front door. And that was always fun, especially when you're drunk. I called my mom and dad, told them where I was, said, oh, I need to come get all my stuff. So we came home, rented a U-Haul, and rented the U-Haul and got all my, you know, my bed, my furniture, all kinds of stuff, and drove it back up to Mammoth. And when I got there, I had to work that night. So we had driven all day with the U-Haul. I had to turn it back into Bishop, 35 miles away from Mammoth. And so I went off to work, and I came home from work at 7 in the morning, and because I was working night shift, and my boyfriend at the time, Steve, he came to save me, remember? And he says, I'm going to drive it down. Either I slept all day or something, but then I got up to go to work, and he says, I'm driving it down to Bishop. I'll turn it in, and then I'll see you in the morning when you get off work. So the next morning, I got off work, and I went home and was going to bed, and here comes Steve, and Steve says, yeah, I turned it in Bishop. And I forgot to tell the story about the... Anyway, first off, 5 minute story, okay? We got up to Mammoth, there was so much snow that we didn't have anywhere to park the U-Haul. So I parked it at the Safeway parking lot, and you're not supposed to park overnight at the Safeway parking. So they packed it in with snow, and I didn't know where it was. We went over there looking for it, and we couldn't find it. So we called the impound yard and said, have you seen a U-Haul? And they said, you mean the one that's packed in with snow over at the Safeway parking lot? So then we went back at Safeway and found it. It had snow. They had pushed all the snow up against it. It was buried in there. And so then I had to pay people to sort of, you know, I don't know if they use shovels, hammers, pitchforks, all kinds of things to try to get the snow broke up so they could get the thing out of there. And so then the guy drives it back to Bishop. And when I see him the next day, I said, how'd it go? Everything went fine. We got it back because I had it in like an extra 3 days because of the blizzard. So we had to make sure it was getting back. And about a month later, I realized I wasn't getting any of my credit card bills, gas cards, different things. And we were sharing a mailbox, my bonding buddy, Steve. And so what had happened is I had given him my credit card to use to go fill it up with gas when he turned it in at Bishop, and he drove all the way to San Diego. I think he went into his mom without shoes and socks on and said these guys were going to beat him up if he didn't give him $350. He bought an eighth of cocaine and drove all the way back and did it all on the way back. But never told me and didn't want to tell me because he was owing for all the gas that he expended on that trip and all that. So about a month later, when I realized I wasn't getting my bills, I said, Steve, what in the hell have you been doing with my bills? Because I finally got it and saw one that, you know, had all this stuff. And I got right in his face and said, Steve, what the hell is going on? And he bopped me one, you know. So me and Rihanna are like this. I had a big old black eye, and I grabbed ice or snow to put on it immediately. We're in his pickup truck, and he admits to me that he stole the U-Haul and drove it all the way home, and that he'd got a gram of cocaine, told his mom that these guys were going to kill him if they didn't, you know, get $350, which he just needed to get the gram, you know, get the cocaine and all that. So he says, what can I do? And I said, go get me some vodka. And so I sat there with this black eye drinking vodka for a day or two. I think I called in sick to work because I was too ashamed and too embarrassed to go. And then I worked at the hospital at night, so there weren't too many people. If I could get past the two or three that I worked with, you know. So I went to work and put this eye shield on and said that I had injured myself. But I was full of so much shame and, you know, all this about where my life was headed and, you know, what's a girl like me doing in a place like this? And here's the guy that's going to save me. He's already fucked me over. And I'm already bonded. And so I went home. And I went home devastated. The drug addict and all those guys that I'd left in the house had spent all, had never paid the gas and electric, which was in my name, and all this. So I had all these bills. I came home 27, 28 years old, defeated, and had to move in with my mom and dad. And that wasn't quite bad enough yet. So about, I got my foot on the ground. I got a job at Grossman Hospital. And I paid off my bills, and I was able to move out again. But by then, I'd moved on to crystal meth and instead of cocaine, because I knew cocaine was the problem, or the bonding was the problem, or something, you know. And am I a half hour now? Oh, God. So I better get sober. So yeah, then I got sober. So, I don't know, I just kept skidding along the bottom, and it was him and him and him, and the last guy that I was with was named Bobby Summers, and he brought me my first AA meeting, and he got sober in February, and he had been living with me off and on, and after he left, I kept calling him when I needed money and say, you know, that last night we did the $100 worth of stuff, and you never paid me, and da-da-da-da-da, and he'd say, we're saving seat for you in Alcoholics Anonymous, Joanne. I'd say, what? He goes, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous now, and we're saving you a seat. And I said, oh, well, when are you giving me my $100, you know? And so I hit along the bottom from February till that last summer. I had a party for my 30-and-a-half birthday party because I always wanted to have a party in the summer, you know, and my birthday was in the winter. And I looked around the room, and the six or seven guys that I just already bonded with, all those guys. And there was one left, and I was looking at him for that night, you know. And I realized that my life was not going very well. And so about this time, my sister's husband was having trouble, and she took him and did an intervention on him and took him to the McDonald's Center. And they were going to get a divorce, and I thought I could help her because I'm a helper. And so I just said, I'll go with you to the meeting, and I'll get Richard to talk to you, you know, because this is just ridiculous, you guys getting divorced over this. He needs to get sober. And I went up there and I sat in the meeting, and they said, alcohol is a drug. A drug is a drug. Alcohol is a disease. I went home and bought a 12-pack, said, God, what the hell were they talking about? And I went on my last run, and all those things started sinking in that they were talking about that treatment center. And so what I, that last run, I was up Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I was up for those 3 days, and I had tried, I think I'd gone to work on Saturday, but I couldn't quite make it on Sunday. So about 3 o'clock in the morning, I called my boss and said, well, I was afraid to call work because, you know, they'd put up that sign about me at Kaiser. So I called, and I didn't want them to write on the board, Joanne called him crazy today, so she can't come to work, you know. So I called up my boss rather than call up somebody that was in charge that day at the hospital and said, I can't come to work. I think I'm an alcoholic. And she says, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm going to the EAP counselor, or, you know, we're gonna get this straightened out. I called the guy that said he would take me to AA. So I had, the following day, I scheduled an EAP. Actually, I was screaming. I was running around in my car screaming, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I show up at people's doors with a beer in my hand. I'm an alcoholic. What am I going to do? And they say, Joanne, go home, or do something. And I ended up at an EAP counselor, and she suggested that I might have a little bit of a problem. I've been using drugs and alcohol for 15 years, and that I probably needed a little help with this. And I think it was after I'd been to that Sunday night meeting. So I went on Monday to the EAP counselor, and she saw that I got into a treatment program. I ended up at the Scripps McDonald Center, and they weren't allowing visitors, which, you know, I didn't have anybody that was going to visit me anyway, but I was really worried about whether or not I could have visitors. You know, the only people I hung out with anymore were the people that I was drinking and using with, but I was so worried that if I got to go to this place, they're not going to allow visitors. And so I got there, and I was willing. I had the fog had broken through. I knew I was alcoholic. I took the first 3 steps up those 3 steps into the McDonald's Center, and I tried to do whatever they suggested. I did what they did wanted me to do at the 30-day program. They said maybe you need to go to a woman's recovery center. And I said, no. You know, that's for, like, drug addicts and, you know, jailbirds. And I haven't been to jail. I hired an attorney. And, you know, and I, you know, and this would probably would have come out. I'm in a doctor's daughter. And so they said, why don't you just go look? Or why don't you write a list? Write a list of the pros and the cons. So I wrote a list of the pros and the cons. And it turns out the pros outweighed the cons. And I went and looked, and it wasn't as bad as I thought. And I went for my interview, and I realized one of my old boyfriend's mother had lived there, and I'd been there before. So when I walked in, I realized that I had been there before, and I didn't know if that was a coincidence or what, because I was starting to get those, you know, kind of little miracles that were happening, little insights that were I could see. And so I said, okay, I'll go, but they don't have a bed, so I'll go home to my apartment. And but I did what they asked. They said, come to the meeting on Sunday and Thursday, call once a week, and try to get into that place. And so I did that. And I got sober September 29th in 86. And I was in treatment most of October. And I called all through November. And December 15th, they got a bed for me at Turning Point Recovery Home. And when I went in there, I thought maybe I should just keep my apartment, pay over here. I'm back to work. I could afford it. You know, I'll just keep my apartment. And then I had to really let go. So I had to let go of that apartment. And I said, I'll go for like 30 days or 90. They said, why don't you try for 90 days? I said, okay, I'll stay for 90 days. And I moved into that woman's recovery home, and things started happening for me. I could see other women that were getting sober and getting their life together. And I started getting unafraid or less afraid of sharing my feelings. You know, we would have different step meetings. We would have meditation in the morning. We would have group meetings. And every night I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had done that with every day since I'd come home from that treatment center. And I'd even go at noon on to the Grove and see Larry there. But I didn't really count noon at the Grove because that wasn't really a meeting. That was entertainment. And we called it sobriety on parade. But so anyway, I lived there for, I ended up, somebody said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I always thought I'd go back and get my bachelor's degree. And so she says, why don't you apply for school? So I applied to school while I was living there. I learned to open up a little bit and talk about my feelings. It was, at first, it was only in the dark with nobody being able to see my face or see me cry. And then I started to get more and more open. And I had a sponsor that I'd gotten as soon as I got out of the treatment center, and she lived in La Jolla, and I was going to the La Jolla newcomer meeting on Monday nights. And somewhere about 90 days, my sponsor and I weren't really connecting because she was up in La Jolla and I couldn't get to the meetings where she was at. So I had Ted Howe sending me tapes at the recovery home, because Bobby Summers was one of, he was the guy who took my first meeting, so Ted was introduced to me early on, and I have, Ted suggested this woman named Joyce, and I didn't know at the time, but he knew she was having a hard time because she just lost her husband, so he got her a newcomer, because she was having trouble, and that's what happens around here, is people take care of people, God takes care of the people that are here. And I got to be her newcomer so that she could get through the death of her husband. And I'm still friendly with Joyce today. I told her that she's still my sponsor, although I'm not a very good sponsee anymore. I don't call her so much anymore. So that, but she's going to my daughter's play next week or 2 weeks from now. And we have known each other my whole sobriety. And she was the first person that I shared my fourth and fifth step with. And she helped me through that. And what happened for me is I started doing the steps with Joyce. And Joyce and I went through 1, 2, and 3. And then she had me busy writing on 4. And I went and did my fifth step with her, but I was sobbing and crying. You know, I wouldn't allow myself to cry when I first got here because I thought if I started crying, I would never stop. So I wouldn't even allow it to start. I'd swallow it down, you know, try to keep it down. And so I cried so much during that fifth step that she says, I think there's more there. You haven't written it all down. So I got pissed off. And I got pissed off, said, I'll never do that again, you know. And it took me a year to get ready to do that, become willing again to do that. And all I did was accept a lot of that stuff that I had written about myself. And it wasn't that I was hiding something that wasn't there. It was just that I accepted it a lot more and was able to talk about it a lot easier when I went through that again with her. And then I did 6 and 7, and, you know, I had my list of 8. And I sort of balked at 9 because I had these list of bonding male friends that I thought owed me more than I owed them, you know. And so I guess over in 86, I don't know when Michael Jackson was popular, but somebody was interviewing Michael Jackson in like 1992. So it probably was 4 or 5 years into my sobriety. And that night I called all these guys on the list because I was willing at that point to do anything because I had started to suffer in my sobriety. I'd started to get stagnant. I'd started to become uncomfortable. And I didn't want to lose what I'd received here. And so I called 3 or 4, maybe 5 of those guys on that night that Michael Jackson was being interviewed. And made my amends. I made my amends with my family. Those ones, some of them were real quick, like when one of my sisters, I think, had left a $20 bill on the table. I made that amend like while I was in treatment. And, you know, gave her back her money that I'd stolen, but I, you know, had to admit to it. But later on, I got to my family. My dad, I thought my problems were all with my mom, because I thought I hated my mom more than I hated my dad, but I didn't know how to love my dad and hate my dad at the same time. So, I don't know, I had a lot of issues around my father. And when I finally went to him with my 9-step to make amends, I went into his office and told him that I was sorry for all that I'd put him through and asked him to forgive me. And I said, as you know, I'm on a new path and I'm trying to do what's right. And I hope that we can, you know, get through this. And my dad, you know, isn't very emotional. He seems to have gotten more emotional as I've gotten older in sobriety, but he turned to me and gave me a hug and said, I never stop loving you. And for that 10 or 15 minutes that my dad turned to me and said that, it was, you know, very healing for me. And I did what was asked of me here. I got through the steps. And then I started having fun. I started having fun in sobriety. How many minutes I got now? I already got sober, Bob. So when I lived in the women's recovery home, I learned about IKIPA. IKIPA is the International Conference of Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they had all gone to Boston. The guy that took me to my first meeting, Bobby, had gone to the IKIPA. So the following year, it was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I said, I want to go. And if you save $5 or $10 every week, you can put some money together and be able to do something like that. And I was able to go to the International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous in Nashville, Tennessee, and went to Dollyland and the Grand Old Opry with a bunch of sober folks. And, you know, I was on the plane with a bunch of the Pacific Group or the, you know, these kids, these young kids from that area that were all sober at the time. And when the stewardess gives you the little thing to tell you how to buckle your seatbelt, they do this whole thing. I don't know, Lori, do you know this? They did this whole thing where they imitated her the whole time and talk about when you put your seatbelt on, when you bring the alcohol, or when you bring the oxygen down and all this. So it's people having fun in sobriety. And that's what I learned, was that people could have fun in sobriety and that I started to get comfortable in my skin. So the following year, I think it was in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I went to the IKIPA in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I went with this girl named Michelle and Allison. Do you remember Allison? Allison and I, and I had always been very self-conscious. Like, I wouldn't do stuff out in front of people because I was afraid what they'd think of me. So it's like I found out I wouldn't bowl because I was afraid they were going to laugh at me for how bad I was and things like that. So I went to this Icky Paw, and we did this thing where we had now had this Tennessee wiggle, and we had the Utah shuffle, and this little dance that we put together. And right before one of the speaker meetings with 3,000 or 4,000 people in this convention center, we got up on the stage and did this thing. And I knew at that moment that it didn't matter what you guys thought about me. It mattered more what I thought about me. And I was okay in doing that. And whether I was, I didn't care what you thought. I was having fun, and it was fun to do that. And I came back here to San Diego around 5 years of my sobriety. We used to go to the Allied Gardens discussion, was it? And it was our home group, and a lot of people I know are from that group. And we had a guy move from Phoenix, Arizona, named Walt. And Walt said, there's this sober singles thing in Texas, and I'd like to get one started here. And so what we did is we put together this sober singles convention, and we did dances every month to raise money to get started and do all this stuff. And, you know, it caused a little controversy in AA because they thought we were being exclusive and that we weren't going to let anybody in that was married. And we would let anybody in. And we wanted people to learn to have fun in sobriety. And the first year it went off okay, and the second or third year I got to be the chairman of that. And it was very, first of all, I learned a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous through the traditions about how to handle conflict and how to, you know, how to do all that kind of stuff in meetings where people disagree with you and all that kind of stuff. And so that was fun. And then I thought, and we were able to put this thing together, and it was just so miraculous that we could have these monthly meetings and put this thing together and have 3,000 people come, and the next year have 3,500 people come and get good speakers. And we were trying to teach people that you didn't have to be always searching for relationships. Sometimes when I was the chairman, I thought, what am I, the big, most desperate woman in AA? Because I'd never been married or, you know, never had any kid, and I was looking, you know. And so I got to be the chairman, and towards the weekend that we had together for that chairmanship meet, when I was the chairman, there were these people sitting around from H&I that had come and worked all day. And somebody came up to me right before the banquet and said, we have 5 tickets. They're gonna serve this many meals, and we might as well give these 5 tickets away. And so I thought, I'm the big cheese. I get to decide who gets to go to this convention for free. And I gave these tickets. I gave one to the H&I guy, and I gave one to somebody else that had participated in helping us with the participation in the convention. I looked around for people that were helping us, you know, that just were greeters or doing stuff. And I thought it was all important and all this. And we sat down to dinner, and somebody came up to me and said, you won't believe it, you gave me a ticket. I'm sitting right next to this newcomer that I met last week in the Alano Club in Chula Vista. And I can't believe it. I haven't seen him since. And, you know, you gave me that ticket, and I'm sitting right next to him. And then somebody else came, and they said, you know, you gave me that ticket, and this is what happened. I ended up seeing a guy that I'd lost in my sobriety, and, you know, I haven't seen him in a long time. And I thought, I didn't do that. God did that, you know. That I'm not the big cheese here. God's the big cheese here. And he has miracles that are waiting to happen for you and I anywhere, you know, we are. And through people in Alcoholics Anonymous, things happen that are miraculous. So I wanted to talk about that. And then my husband, with the fingers going like this right now, telling me to wrap it up. I guess I'll just skip him. My husband, when I the week before I went into treatment, the whole week I was a whole week out loose going to AA meetings before they actually took me in treatment, because it took them a week to get me organized to get in. And so I sobered up on my own at AA meetings and went in already detoxed to treatment. But that was the weekend of the Southern California Convention in town. So it's here every 3 years, you know, or it used to be. Long Beach, Bakersfield here. So my sister and her husband that had broken up through the intervention were going to go down there to that, and so I went with my sister. And I'm sitting at the dance on a Thursday night at the Southern California Convention, and my husband was there, and he came up and asked me to dance. And this was the 1980s, so he looked like Don Johnson from the Miami Vice. He had the white cotton jacket on. He had the loafers on with no socks. He had tan feet, you know. I thought, what is this guy asking? I'm 3 days sober. He's asking me to dance, and I'm going, he must like my sister, you know. That's how much self-esteem I had, you know. He was just getting to her through me, you know, because I look like the easy mark. But he asked me to dance, and I danced with him, and it ended up, once I got out of treatment and started coming to meetings in the East County, that a lot of the meetings that I went to in La Mesa, he was at, and we started seeing each other regular. So I've known my husband since I was 3 days sober. And he would date women, and I would date men. And then we'd all go out to coffee with this spiritual guru that we had. And we'd sit and talk about the miserable life we were having with men and women in sobriety. One month it would be him, and 3 months later it would be me. Terry Smith would say, trust God and keep walking. Trust God and keep walking. He's fixing somebody ready for you. They'll be ready for you anytime, you know. He'll be fixing somebody ready for you, and you just don't know when it's going to happen. And at 9 years of sobriety, my husband asked me out, and I went, I'm not going to sleep with you. I mean, I thought, this is a guy I've been friends with for 9 years. I'm not going to sleep with him and then go, oh, yeah, we're going to be friends again, you know, or not be friends again after being good friends for 9 years. So, you know, we went to coffee a couple times. He took me to a meeting. He was going to take me to the beach. He called me and said, let's go to the beach. And I said, I need to talk to you when you get here, because I was going to try to get brave enough to ask him what the hell he wanted, you know. And he came over, and he says, well, he was all stressed out because I had told him 2 hours before that I wanted to talk to him, and he wouldn't know what he wanted to talk about, you know. So we came over, and I went on one side of the bed, and he went on the other because I couldn't stand too close to him while I was talking to him. And I said, well, I'm not sure what your intentions are, you know. I just don't know. I want to get married, and I want to have kids, and you've already done all that, And I won't sleep with you just because you want to, you know. And he goes, well, you haven't even asked me what my intent, you know. He said something like, you don't know what I want. Maybe I want to do all that again. He goes, I did it all drunk, and maybe now I'd like to try it sober. And I went, oh, uh-oh. So we got hot and heavy shortly after that. And that was August or September. By February 7th, because he couldn't wait till Valentine's Day, he asked me to marry him. And it cured me of the common cold. I got my ring, and then I felt better. I wasn't going to go to the meeting, but I felt better enough that I need to go to the meeting now. Show everybody my ring. And we decided to get married in September, and I wanted to lose 10 pounds for the wedding, so I went off my birth control, and I got pregnant right before we got married. And so at 40 years old, I got married for the very first time to my husband, and one day at a time, we've stayed married for 12 and a half years. And in our first year, we had my first child, his fourth child, and she's the love of our life. Is that good enough, Joanne? I forgot to mention Zoe last time. I participate. I told you at the beginning that I learned to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here. And now I participate in life. I participate. I go to work when I'm supposed to. I do call in mental health days every once in a while, but, you know, not like I did before. They haven't assumed me dead at home or anything. I participate in my daughter's school. I participate on her softball team. I'm the cookie mom for the Girl Scouts. She's been in a a play for the last 3 years called Peter Pan Junior Theater, and the parents have to take an active role, and they all have to be on a different committee, and my husband and I have both participated in that. And she's learning to be a responsible human being as well as being in musicals, and to be on time, and to be respectful of adults, and thank them for their help with their committee work, and all that stuff that we learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she told me my skirt was too short today. I borrowed her eyeliner. She's only 11. But we are a happy family today. And we still, she knows that we go to Alcoholics Anonymous. We all, I started talking about Icky Paws. We went to conventions together. Rick had a girlfriend in 1985? 90, we went to Seattle. He had a girlfriend. I had a girlfriend. Yeah, I just had a friend. I was single for a long time in there. And we knew each other then, and we did the 90 convention together. We did the 95 here together and participated in Alcoholics Anonymous and worked on the 95 convention here. In 2000, we went to the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Zoe was about 3 years old, and she rode around in the car, and we'd make songs. We'd go, my mom and dad are going, we're going to Minneapolis. And we walked down the street in La Mesa Boulevard, and I didn't notice these folks, but she says, I think those people over there were drunk. I said, what makes you think? She goes, they were loud, and they were, you know. Because I've pointed out, you know, one time we were at a taco shop late at night one night, and this girl kind of stumbles in. I'm going to get her burrito because she's too drunk and trying to. So I've been there. Yeah. I knew it, you know. Like, I've been at a baseball game where you go, maybe a hot dog. And so this girl wandered into the taco stand, and Zoe goes, what's the matter with her? And I said, she's drunk. She's drunk. And she goes, because her boyfriend was having to hold her up and different things. So she's been, never seen us drunk, but she knows what drunk is. She knows that we still go to meetings. She knows that her mom and dad are sober by the grace of God in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's made one-year cakes for Rick's sponsees. She's, you know, helped make my birthday cakes and all that. And so I think she has a chance. She's still got a path that she's got to take. Next Saturday, she'll be 12. I'm 53 with a 12-year-old. And we'll see what happens. But she knows that her mom and dad are sober, and we have an open relationship. We're able to talk about it, things. You know, I talk about boys and, you know, whether she has a boyfriend. Told her she's not allowed to have a boyfriend. And I said, what would you do if you had a boyfriend? She says, I don't know. And I said, well, what if you saw your boyfriend in the hall, what would you do? She goes, I'd probably just say hi. I go, then you don't need to have a boyfriend yet, you know. So, I might give him a hug, you know. So, anyway, so I'm happy today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm nowhere near the place that I was in when I got here. And if you are new here, there is a lot to offer here. But you have to do the work. You have to come to go to meetings. You have to participate in service and other things. And you have to get honest with somebody. You find somebody that you could share with, and you do the steps. And is that it? Oh, I brought my prop, remember? I got one more thing. At my wedding, we said this prayer, and I love this prayer. It's in the front of this non-AA approved literature, 24 hours a day, which was the only book they had when we got here. Anyway, it says, look to this day, for it is life, the very life of lives. In its brief course lie all the realities and verities, that means truth, of existence, the bliss of growth, the splendor of action, the glory of power. For yesterday is but a dream, and tomorrow is only a vision. But today, well lived, makes every yesterday a dream of happiness, and every tomorrow a vision of help. Look well, therefore, to this day. Thank you.